I'm glad we could be back together this afternoon. It's been an encouraging day of worship, and I'm glad that it's not over yet. On Sunday afternoons, we have been looking at the letter of 1 Timothy, and we've talked about how this is a letter that was written to Timothy by Paul after his first Roman imprisonment. Timothy is stationed in Ephesus while Paul is in Macedonia. And it's around 62 or 63 AD. And as Timothy is working there in Ephesus, Paul is giving him and the church instructions about how to do that work effectively. And we've noticed how much emphasis is placed on sound doctrine or healthy teaching. Paul wants Timothy and the church to be mindful of the importance of having teaching that accurately communicates the gospel of Jesus and produces the fruit of that in the lives of those who believe it. And so, to this point, Paul has largely focused on different roles in the church. Men's roles, women's roles, overseers, deacons, preachers. But now, he focuses on relationships. Here in chapter 5, he begins to talk about how different people ought to interact with one another. So we'll begin here in 1 Timothy chapter 5, verses 1 and 2. He says, "Do not rebuke an older man, but encourage him as you would a father. Younger men as brothers, older women as mothers, younger women as sisters in all purity." So it's important that Paul reminds Timothy of the family dynamic that the Lord has created in the church. This is not the first time he's mentioned this kind of idea. Back in chapter 3 and verse 15, he told Timothy, "If I delay, you may know how one ought to behave in the household of God, which is the church of the living God." And so it's important for us to remember that the church is not just a club. It's not just an institution. It is a family. It's God's family. And because of that, it's important that we treat each other like family. I think there's a lot that we could say about each one of these dynamics, but there are some themes here in the way that Paul tells Timothy to interact with different people. If someone is younger than you, you should be gentle with them. You should expect them to have some immaturity. And so you should treat them the way you would treat a son or a daughter. If someone is older than you, you should be respectful with them, like you would with your parents or your grandparents. And if somebody is around the same age as you, you should be patient with them, as you ought to be with a brother or a sister. That's not to say that anyone is above rebuke or correction. Later in this chapter, Paul will actually talk about how to rebuke elders. But what he's talking about is a spirit of love that should always be present in our relationships. We are family. We ought to remember that we are family. And in all of our interactions, even when there's tension, the love should be present. I do think it's important to notice that Paul emphasizes purity with younger women here. And I think it's because Paul recognizes the potential dangers that come with relationships between men and women sometimes. He's not saying that men and women need to stay totally separate. He's not saying that men and women have to sit on opposite sides of the auditorium. He's not saying that they can never speak to each other. Brothers and sisters will talk together and laugh together, sometimes even hug each other. But those relationships need to stay pure. And there have been too many churches that have been wrecked by brothers and sisters forgetting the importance of that. Too many preachers have ruined their work by forgetting the importance of this. And so we ought to be committed to maintaining purity in our relationships. Let's not be naive about that, but remember just how seriously things can get messed up when we neglect it. But it's with that that Paul turns to a particular relationship to be mindful of in the church, and that is how the church relates to widows. And so we'll read verses 3 through 16 here. Continuing in verse 3, he says, "Honor widows who are truly widows. But if a widow has children or grandchildren, let them first learn to show godliness to their own household and to make some return to their parents, for this is pleasing in the sight of God. She who is truly a widow, left all alone, has set her hope on God and continues in supplications and prayers night and day. But she who is self-indulgent is dead even while she lives. Command these things as well, so that they may be without reproach. But if anyone does not provide for his relatives, and especially for members of his household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. Let a widow be enrolled if she is not less than 60 years of age, having been the wife of one husband and having a reputation for good works. If she has brought up children, has shown hospitality, has washed the feet of the saints, has cared for the afflicted, and has devoted herself to every good work. But refuse to enroll younger widows, for when their passions draw them away from Christ, they desire to marry, and so incur condemnation for having abandoned their former faith. Besides that, they learn to be idlers, going about from house to house, and not only idlers, but also gossips and busybodies, saying what they should not. So I would have younger widows marry, bear children, manage their households, and give the adversary no occasion for slander. For some have already strayed after Satan. If any believing woman has relatives who are widows, let her care for them. Let the church not be burdened, so that it may care for those who are truly widows." So there's a lot here in this text. There's a lot of lessons that we could take out of it and apply. But I'd like for us to think about it from three angles: directions for families, directions for churches, and directions for widows. I think we can break it down into those three sections. So first, directions for families. It starts by saying here in verse 3, honor widows who are truly widows. Some translations say honor widows who are widows indeed. And that always confused me when I was a kid. How can a widow not truly be a widow? How can a widow not be a widow indeed? Is she hiding a few secret husbands somewhere? That's not the idea. The idea is communicated there in verse 5, though. She who is truly a widow indeed, is somebody who is left all alone. The NIV says here in verse 3, give proper recognition to those widows who are really in need. And verse 4 gives us the responsibilities that fall to families. He says, if a widow has children or grandchildren, let them first learn to show godliness to their own household and to make some return to their parents, for this is pleasing in the sight of God. He says in verse 8, if anyone does not provide for his relatives, and especially for members of his household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. And then in verse 16, if any believing woman has relatives who are widows, let her care for them. Let the church not be burdened, so that it may care for those who are truly widows. And so Paul's teaching here, I think, is very clear for our physical family relationships. That if we want to honor God, we ought to honor the responsibilities that are present in those relationships. Sometimes we quote from these verses to talk about a husband and a father's responsibility to care for and provide for his wife and his children. And I think that principle is true. But here, Paul is actually arguing for children taking care of their parents. And so if we are privileged to have our parents into their old age, we ought to consider it a great opportunity to continue to love them and show them appreciation for the love they showed us. And with that in mind, ideally, churches shouldn't have to care for widows. Because if a widow has physical family who can provide for her needs, they ought to provide for her. And God has designed the family structure to be the primary means by which individuals are cared for. But Paul goes on to give some responsibilities to churches, some directions for churches who have needy widows among them. Because the reality is, there will often be needy saints among us. And when needy saints are among us, that means we have needy family among us. And we ought to treat them the same way we would treat physical family. And here specifically, he talks about widows being those who would often fall into a state of need. And the directions that Paul gives here and the specific instructions that are given to us in the New Testament are very consistent with what we see throughout the Bible. God has always shown a special concern for widows. In fact, in Psalm 68 in verse 5, he identifies himself as father of the fatherless and protector of widows. And throughout the Old Testament, God was constantly providing for those and looking out for those who couldn't look out for themselves. Specifically, he advocated for the fair treatment of foreigners, for the poor, for orphans, and for widows. He said in Exodus 22, in verse 22, "You shall not mistreat any widow or fatherless child. If you do mistreat them and they cry out to me, I will surely hear their cry and my wrath will burn and I will kill you with the sword and your wives shall become widows and your children fatherless." And so God takes this very seriously, and we ought to as well. So how does all of that translate to the church's responsibility towards needy widows? Well, here you might notice that Paul talks about letting a widow be enrolled. At the beginning of verse 9, "Let a widow be enrolled if she is not less than 60 years of age, having been the wife of one husband," and so forth. And then also in verse 11, "Refuse to enroll younger widows," and he gives his reasons why for that. I think in the context, Paul is talking about a church keeping a list of the widows that they support on an ongoing basis. That if we enter into this kind of continual relationship where we are providing for a widow's needs, she has to meet some qualifications. But if she does, we ought to take her on in an ongoing way to provide for her needs on a continual basis. And in verse 16, when he says, "Let the church not be burdened, so that it may care for those who are truly widows," the implication is that that is exactly the kind of thing that the church should be burdened with, if you want to use that phrase. The kind of thing that the church should be using its resources for is to provide for the needy saints that are among them. And I think this helps us to better understand what the mission of Jesus was all about. You know, Jesus' mission was not to go into the world and transform society. His mission was not to transform governments. His mission was not to transform the social order. His mission was to transform individuals, to call people like you and me out of the world, out of society. But when we come together, we create a new society. We're a part of a different kingdom. We're citizens of a different government. And in this kingdom, in this government, in this family, we can eliminate need from among us. You know, that's what the examples are in the book of Acts. If you go over to Acts chapter 2, Acts chapter 2 and verse 44, it says, "And all who believed were together and had all things in common, and they were selling their possessions and belongings and distributing the proceeds to all as any had need." In chapter 4, in verse 32, "Now the full number of those who believed were of one heart and soul, and no one said that any of the things that belonged to him was his own, but they had everything in common. And with great power, the apostles were giving their testimony to the resurrection of the Lord Jesus, and great grace was upon them all. There was not a needy person among them, for as many as were owners of lands or houses sold them and brought the proceeds of what was sold and laid it at the apostles' feet, and it was distributed to each as any had need. And so what we see happening is that the church is a family of believers who is actually able to take care of each other to the degree that there is no need among them. Their mission was not to go out into the world to transform society, but coming out of the world, they formed a new society where their faithfulness to the Lord meant taking care of one another. And so when we care for each other the way we ought to, none of us should be in need. Saw some really good examples this weekend of vehicles breaking down and vehicles being shared. It's the kind of thing we're talking about. But here, Paul is talking about those who will be continually in need. And he's talking about the widows who will need continuing support from the family of God. And so, let's talk now about the directions that he gives to them. You'll notice that Paul does give a list of qualifications for widows who are supported in this ongoing or permanent way. Verse 9 says that she must not be less than 60 years of age, that she must have been the wife of one husband, which, interestingly enough, is the exact same phrase in chapter 3 and verse 2, describing overseers. Back in chapter 3 and verse 2, he said, overseers must be the husband of one wife. So it is interesting to me that this widow is considered the wife of one husband, even after her husband has died. So that's something to chew on. But just like we looked at all of the qualifications for overseers and were able to organize them into three categories, so we can do here with the widows. She must demonstrate character, faith, and competence. Paul is describing a godly woman who has demonstrated her devotion to the Lord in the way that she's lived her life. And he goes on to give some practical instructions also. He advises younger widows to seek remarriage. He cites the temptations that come if they don't. He says in verse 11, refuse to enroll younger widows, for when their passions draw them away from Christ, they desire to marry, and so incur condemnation for having abandoned their former faith. He talks about the temptation to be idlers and busybodies and gossips. You know, it's not actually a Bible verse that says idle hands are the devil's workshop, but it might as well be. And this concept is taught here for sure. When we don't focus our efforts productively, we leave ourselves open to getting involved in things we shouldn't. And so Paul is advising these younger widows to seek remarriage. But I think in this, there's also an important point to notice. He's encouraging them to see that their lives are not over. I imagine a young widow would feel like that. She'd feel like, that's it. My life is over. It didn't go the way that I wanted it to go. I might just be tempted to quit. And Paul would never discount their grief. But here, he encourages them to keep moving forward. And I think that's good advice for all of us. All of us will experience setbacks in life that threaten to overwhelm us. There may be times when we feel like everything has fallen apart. But if we keep walking by faith, we can find new and different ways to serve the Lord. And ultimately, that's what he's encouraging these younger widows to do. Jesus said in John chapter 15 and verse 2, every branch in me that does not bear fruit, he takes away. And every branch that does bear fruit, he prunes, that it may bear more fruit. And so, whatever situation we might face in life, I think the principle is this. What might seem like the end might just be a new beginning. What might seem like a disaster may just be a time of pruning. And the best way to navigate trials in life is to keep moving forward with our eyes on serving the Lord. Now, with that being said, the last section in chapter 5 is about the relationship with elders. And I'll read verses 17 to 25. He says, "Let the elders who rule well be considered worthy of double honor, especially those who labor in preaching and teaching. For the scripture says, 'You shall not muzzle an ox when it treads out the grain, and the laborer deserves his wages.' Do not admit a charge against an elder except on the evidence of two or three witnesses. As for those who persist in sin, rebuke them in the presence of all, so that the rest may stand in fear. In the presence of God and of Christ Jesus and of the elect angels, I charge you to keep these rules without prejudging, doing nothing from partiality. Do not be hasty in the laying on of hands, nor take part in the sins of others. Keep yourself pure. No longer drink only water, but use a little wine for the sake of your stomach and your frequent ailments. The sins of some people are conspicuous, going before them to judgment, but the sins of others appear later. So also good works are conspicuous, and even those that are not cannot remain hidden." Now, what I want you to notice is that the general theme of this part of the letter is of showing honor. In verse 3, he says, "Honor widows who are truly widows." Now in verse 17, he says, "Let the widows who rule well be considered worthy of double honor." And in the context here, that includes both respecting them and paying them as they deserve. Paul cites Deuteronomy 25 in verse 4 and verse 18. He does the same thing in 1 Corinthians 9 when he argues for paying preachers who need support. He says, "You shall not muzzle an ox when it treads out the grain." And in 1 Corinthians 9, he asks the question, "Do you really think it was for oxen that God was concerned?" The principle here is that if we have elders who are preaching and teaching and need support, we ought to support them, even financially, that they are worthy of that. And he refers to a principle found throughout the law in verse 19. "Do not admit a charge against an elder except on the evidence of two or three witnesses." But then he gives the direction in verse 20, "As for those who persist in sin, rebuke them in the presence of all, so that the rest may stand in fear." So you might notice there is some tension there. Elders are worthy of respect. Elders deserve the benefit of the doubt. And yet, not even elders are above judgment and correction. So it takes a great deal of humility and wisdom to know how to navigate each situation that might present itself. But based on that difficulty, I think verses 21 to 25 are meant to help us make wise judgments. You know, he says in verse 21 to keep these rules without prejudging, doing nothing from partiality. If you show prejudice, if you prejudge somebody, you're apt to make some pretty poor judgments. You're looking for reasons to be upset, and if you look hard enough, you'll find reasons to be upset, even if they're not there. But then, in verse 22, "Do not be hasty in the laying on of hands." I think the idea there is not being hasty in appointing elders, laying your hands on them, commissioning them to the work, because after all, you really need to know somebody. And if you make decisions without getting to know somebody, you're also apt to make some poor judgments. It takes time to make an accurate assessment. And I think that's the idea in verses 24 and 25. That the sins of some people are conspicuous. They're more visible. They go before them to judgment, but the sins of others appear later. Good works are the same. Sometimes good works are conspicuous, and even those that are not cannot remain hidden. Some people are really good at hiding their sins. Some people are really good at hiding their good works. That whole "don't let your left hand know what your right hand is doing" can make that tricky sometimes. God will reveal everything eventually. All the secrets will come out. But given enough time, we tend to see each other more accurately too. And we tend to appreciate those who are truly devoted and sincere. And we tend to see through those who aren't. And so Paul is giving us some practical wisdom here, realizing that situations may not always be exactly as they appear. And so because we ought to take these judgments very seriously, we ought to be cautious about making them and how we handle them. Now, I realize chapter 5 is the longest chapter in 1 Timothy, but even so, we're going to peek ahead into chapter 6 for two verses. And that's because this whole discussion really is completed in 1 Timothy 6, verses 1 and 2. Chapter 5 and verse 3 says, honor widows who are truly widows. 5:17 says, let the elders who rule well be considered worthy of double honor. And now in chapter 6 and verse 1, he says, let all who are under a yoke as bondservants regard their own masters as worthy of all honor. So again, this theme of honor being showed to widows, to elders, and now to masters is completed in these verses. But the reason why he says that those who are under a yoke as bondservants should regard their masters as worthy of honor is so that the name of God and the teaching may not be reviled. And he goes on to say in verse 2, those who have believing masters must not be disrespectful on the ground that they are brothers. Rather, they must serve all the better, since those who benefit by their good service are believers and beloved. We might recall what Paul wrote in Ephesians chapter 6. And I think that helps us to understand a little bit more about what he's talking about. Remember, Paul is writing to Timothy while he's in Ephesus. And in Ephesians chapter 6 in verse 5, he wrote on this subject. Bondservants, obey your earthly masters with fear and trembling, with a sincere heart, as you would Christ. Not by the way of eye service as people pleasers, but as bondservants of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart, rendering service with a good will as to the Lord and not to man, knowing that whatever good anyone does, he will receive back from the Lord, whether he is a bondservant or is free. Masters, do the same to them, and stop your threatening, knowing that he who is both their master and yours is in heaven, and that there is no partiality with him. The principle here is that everything that we do is to the glory of God. No part of life is excluded. Our responsibilities as Christians extend to all of our relationships with everyone we interact with, and so Christians should honor their bosses or their masters, even when they're bosses and masters are ungodly. And it's not because their bosses are worthy of honor, but Christ is. That's the mentality that we take. Now, what about if you happen to be in business with a Christian? What if your boss is a believer or your employee is a believer? How does that change things? I think Paul realizes that the temptation might be to think, well, that means you can slack off, because surely your brother would understand. And he says, no, it's exactly the opposite. You have all the more reason to honor them. You can show them honor all the better because of that relationship. You know, I was just talking to somebody recently who has been in business with brethren, and he's had brethren that he's worked with and had brethren that he's provided goods and services for. And I've heard this often, how people have remarked that sometimes those are the worst relationships instead of the best, as you might expect. Sometimes brethren can be the worst co-workers and the worst customers. They think that just because they're family, they deserve the family discount. Paul says that mentality is completely backwards. If we would show respect and honor to people in the world in these relationships, we ought to be showing respect and honor to each other. And if the goal is that the name of God and the teaching would not be reviled, we need to remember that others are watching the way we treat each other. If we're fair, if we're honest, if we're generous, those are things that make an impression on people who are observing. And so we need to treat outsiders with love and respect, but we also need to treat one another with love and respect in these relationships too. I was thinking about how to draw all of these verses to some conclusions, and I was just thinking about how these verses help to define the relationships that we have in Christ. And the first principle is that Christianity maintains responsibilities in physical relationships. And this applies to all of our physical relationships. Parents and children, husbands and wives, employees and employers, citizens and governments. Just because we become a Christian, it doesn't mean that we're suddenly free to neglect all of those responsibilities and relationships. I like the way that Peter says it in 1 Peter chapter 2. 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 13. Be subject for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether it be to the emperor as supreme or to governors sent by him to punish those who do evil and to praise those who do good. For this is the will of God, that by doing good you should put to silence the ignorance of foolish people. Live as people who are free, not using your freedom as a cover-up for evil, but living as servants of God. Honor everyone. Love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the emperor. And so Paul tells Christians to stay with their unbelieving spouses in 1 Corinthians 7. Peter tells Christians to be subject to their unbelieving masters here in 1 Peter 2. Whatever the circumstances of our physical relationships, we ought to be subject for the Lord's sake. And by doing good, we can put to silence the ignorance of foolish people. So that's the first principle, that Christianity maintains the responsibilities that we have in our physical relationships. But secondly, Christianity creates responsibilities in spiritual relationships. Beyond the responsibilities that we might already have to our physical family, in Christ we have new family, and that comes with new responsibilities. The church is the family of God, and so we ought to do everything that we can to care for one another as God intends. We should treat older men and women like fathers and mothers, younger men and women like brothers and sisters. We should be especially sensitive to those who are in need. And that applies to both physical needs and spiritual needs. If there's somebody among us that has physical needs, and we know about it, we have the responsibility to act like family and take care of them. If it's a widow who meets the qualifications that Paul talks about, we should take them in on an ongoing basis to provide for them. But the principle is much larger than that. Paul tells Timothy in 1 Timothy 5 and verse 20, as for those who persist in sin, rebuke them in the presence of all, so that the rest may stand in fear. On the one hand, he's talking about providing for the physical needs of widows, and on the other hand, he's talking about providing for the spiritual needs of the brethren. And sometimes that looks like tough love. But as the family of God, we have a responsibility to look out for each other in both ways. If you saw a family member who was showing signs of alcoholism, you would have a responsibility to go to them and to talk to them and to try to help them. And if we notice one of our own who shows signs of struggling spiritually, we owe it to them to go and ask how we can help, to hold each other responsible, and to encourage each other to be faithful to the Lord. Paul says in Galatians 6, 1 and 2, brothers, if anyone is caught in any transgression, you who are spiritual should restore him in a spirit of gentleness. Keep watch on yourself, lest you be tempted. Bear one another's burdens, and so fulfill the law of Christ. And so we've seen now Christianity maintains responsibilities in our physical relationships. Christianity creates responsibilities in spiritual relationships. And even further, Christianity enhances responsibilities when physical and spiritual relationships overlap. Sometimes our physical relationships and spiritual relationships do overlap. Sometimes your boss is also your brother. Sometimes your wife is also your sister. And when those relationships overlap, what does that mean? Does it mean that we can neglect our responsibilities to each other? No, the principles Paul's teaching here are that we have all the more reason to uphold those responsibilities. In 1 Timothy 6, in verse 2, he talks about those who have believing masters not being disrespectful on the ground that they are brothers. Rather, they must serve all the better, since those who benefit by their good service are believers and beloved. And so I think this helps to guide us in all of the relationships that we have with people. If we have an unbelieving boss or an unbelieving spouse or an unbelieving parent, we have a tremendous opportunity to let them see Christ in us in the way that we treat them. But if we're blessed to have a believing boss or a believing spouse or a believing parent, we have reason to serve them all the better, knowing that they are a child of God. And so let's not take the physical relationships for granted because of the spiritual, but let the spiritual enhance the physical because of what we have in common. And when these relationships overlap, our responsibilities to each other are enhanced, and we can continue to show the Christ who lives in us. That's the lesson for this evening. Next Lord's Day, we will plan to finish the book of 1 Timothy in 1 Timothy chapter 6. But this afternoon, there may be somebody who realizes that they are outside of Christ and doesn't want to let the day conclude without making that change that they want to make. There may be somebody here who has some kind of spiritual struggle and you want to ask for help with that. And as the family of God, we invite you to come to our Father, to find all of the help that you need. And if we can assist you in some way, we would invite you to let us know while we stand together and sing.